about it. It's really something that everybody has to take personal possession over.
Yeah, I think you're right, Dennis. Be prepared. So, lack of information. Flight 587 crashed because those pilots had a lack of proper information as to what they, two horizontal cyclones, the wind turbulence that comes off of a heavy airplane that's in front of them. Those people who died during those heat waves that happened once every 20 years or so. Lack of information. And so lots and lots of people, I think, went into their basement in order to recover what they thought was valuable as the seawater started coming in. I think I heard somebody called NJW or something like that that wants to sign in. Who was that? KQRIW?
3JIW again.
Go right ahead, Jim.
Celsius. I think a body that drowns is inhaling the water while the body is alive, and the water is bubbly, frothy. Heart attacks, if it doesn't stop the heart, then breathing may have continued in the water. It may be much harder to tell whether they drowned or unless breathing stopped before the lungs filled with water. I'm not in the autopsy business. By the way, a topic for another night, because I think everybody has experiences. How many people have been hit by voltage? I've been hit by DC and AC, but I don't think it's a night for that. That'd be another night. How we've jolted ourselves when and we're still here to talk about it.
That's a darn good question, Jim. I think we could almost word it the other way around. Who has not? We have all in the process of becoming electronic enthusiasts, ham radio operators and whatever. Almost every one of us from time to time have done something where we felt the electrical current flowing through our body. I can remember when I was 16, 17 years of age building myself a 807 transmitter. And I remember starting the wiring of the secondary winding of the power transformer, 800 volts, cenotaph, 850 volt cenotaph. And I didn't realize the power was on. And I put my two fingers across the two wires of the 850 volts. And lucky for me, my fingers made very light contact, but I got a very strong response in a hurry. And had the timing of that been a little bit different, had my fingers made a little bit better contact, the way that was happening between left hand and right hand, each hand holding on to one of the ends of the wire of that 850 volt secondary winding power transformer, that could have done it to me. Can you top that one, Jim? The E3JIW, K2RIW.
See, off an electromagnetic speaker gave me a burn and caused my elbow to shoot straight back, missing the edge of the wooden cabinet, old tube radio. 347, one hand touching painted metal cabinet, back of finger touching 347, it's 600 with 347 to ground. That, I will say one thing, if you get hit by a higher voltage, go to a hospital, get them to do a chart. If your heart is off rhythm, they can put it back. If you, hey, you're still alive after being shot, you could be fine, except your heart could be off rhythm, and you would die days later of heart attack. So, when a kid asked me, he's 20, I'm 45, 56 now, anyway, he got hit, and I said, look, it's bad, it's workers' comp, we're a small company, but go to the hospital, say you got hit, they'll put you on a chart because you need to know. So we all, when we got zapped, probably should have gone to hospital and been checked out.
And in that checkout, what is your recommendation? A electrocardiogram? Is that probably the best way to make sure that all the timing of all the chambers is working correctly? Back to you, Jim.
I'm a firearm guy and a ham radio and a... I was thrilled when I heard somebody's giving James a Simpson meter. My nephew knows what it is. He's 16, and I said he's getting a Simpson meter, the best of the best in affordable meters. Yeah, I think it's an ECG. It's to know your heart rhythm is not off. And he was 347 to ground that he got hit, and he did go to hospital. I did check him out, and he got a clean bill of health, but people have died days later after getting hit.
Now, the people who have died later after getting a minor electrocution event, is that personal experience that you know of, is there a slim possibility here that the story got a little bit lost in translation? Do you have good reason to believe that there is a one-to-one relationship between the partial electrocution and the cardiac arrest some number of days later, as opposed to maybe the portion already had coronary artery disease, and this was just an additional aggravating factor? Back to you, Jim, K2RIW.
It's only incidental, anecdotal evidence of somebody passing away, but it was in a discussion with an electrician that had switchgear explode and lost a lot of his face, and most of his face was plastic, he pointed it out. He didn't look weird, but he's lucky. I have heard it, different sources, that you have to be checked out, but I think it may be anecdotal evidence. I never Googled it. Or a search engine of your choice. I have no royalties or stock.
Yeah, the usual thing that happens when the heart becomes mistimed, atrial fibrillation, ventral fibrillation, whatever, you'll know by way of the... You'll know, C-O-N, let's see, that's Tom. You'll know by way of the palpitations and whatever. You will feel differently. I believe it's relatively difficult for you to have a significant timing error of the heart that would not give you symptoms of palpitations, lightheadedness, fetal edema. All kinds of crazy symptoms would take place if you had a continuous condition of mistiming of the heart. That's my belief, but we'll have to look into that a little bit further. To the B2CLN, K2RIW. Go ahead, Tom. I'm pretty sure I heard a break by CLN. Are you there, Tom? Okay. I'll save the other piece of information, which is my experiment with chocolate bars. We're getting a little bit late, and we didn't have our more serious science experiments discussion tonight. We had a lot of other discussions. Anybody want to bring up a subject that we should be talking about, give me a call. That is right now, K2RIW.
You know, if somebody always triggers it, I can't get in here. Yes, I'm here with a comment, Dick.
We're hearing you very well, Tom, so go right ahead.
High voltage, and, I think back, let's see, it was the late 1970s. I built an amplifier with a single... 4CX250, and the power supply was close to 3,000 volts, no load, and I accidentally touched that voltage with just one finger and knocked me across the room. Nasty. So, you know, it's a matter of what is the voltage and current and how you are connected as a circuit, I guess you'd say, as a circuit to what it is. Normally 120 volts won't kill, but if you're in the water or, you know, something like that, yes, it will kill. I think of when I was working for a power supply company, it was a half a million power supply, and the meter said something like, I forgot. Now, I was in the microamp region, you know. However, there was a lot of current before the circuit breaker tripped. Poor design, you might say. Anyway, the guy did touch it, and he was killed. I forgot what the time was before a trip, but the guy was dead, you know? Go ahead.
Yeah, the amount of time it takes for an electrocution, I think, could be an extremely brief period of time. If the voltage is right and the timing is right with reference to that RST wave of your heart, if it hits that critical time of the application, I wouldn't be a bit surprised to find a small fraction of a second can set you into fibrillation, and if you're not defibrillated, you'll die in a very small number of minutes. There is some belief that as the voltage gets higher and higher, and it's a brief application, that in some cases it's a little bit safer, because although it's creating a disruption, it is simultaneously doing a defibrillation. A defibrillator is really applying a certain number of joules at a relatively high voltage across your chest in order to reset the timing of the heart. The heart is really, if I understand correctly, it's sort of like a ring resonator. In other words, there's you want a single pulse to be traveling around this ring as part of the heart timing mechanism, and there are certain tap points on that ring where at this point in time the upper ventricle is supposed to go, and then the upper atrium is supposed to go, and at this point of time the ventricle is supposed to go left and right. There's four objects that have to go at the right time, and there are tap points on this ring, and it's supposed to be only one single pulse running around in that ring. And my understanding of what I think a fibrillation situation is, let me drop, is where more than one pulse gets created, and more than one pulse is running around in that ring, and therefore the timing gets really kind of random. And so eventually the individual chambers of the heart are getting commands at much too quick a time, and they're just sitting there quivering and never get a chance to really complete a pumping cycle, and the valves never get a chance to truly open and close, and no real blood is flowing per se. That's my understanding of what fibrillation is. And a defibrillator basically gives you a massive amount of voltage that resets the whole thing. It's a do-over command. It's a reboot. You reboot the heart, is my understanding of what a defibrillator does. So if you touch for a brief enough period of time a high enough voltage, you're doing a kind of defibrillation, which could be a little bit safer, but there's a catch. Put that high enough voltage across the person for a long enough period of time, and now the total wattage of dissipation is going to be giving heat damage to certain organs, and that's not good. The amount of current that flows during that brief period out of a defibrillator for very brief periods does no real significant amount of thermal heating. You sustain that amount of voltage for any length of time, and you're going to be doing damage, is my understanding. I'm not an expert in this area. I'm just telling you what little I know. And with any further questions or comments, give me your call letters, K2LAW on the TechNet.
KD2AOC with a comment.
All right, go ahead, Dennis. By the way, I am hearing somebody else making a comment on the input frequency, but because he doesn't have a PL oscillator, he's not coming through the machine. All right, go ahead, Dennis.
Actually, wouldn't that be a caudial infarction? I mean, I haven't gone on the internet, but isn't that an infarction? The other thing is that when I was a kid, probably in the late 60s, early 70s, I found an old TV that was thrown out and decided to take it apart and got in there, and I got zapped across the sidewalk with this TV that was sitting there. So I think my nickname is Sparky. Over.
So I think you're saying it was a not plugged in television set sitting on the sidewalk, and because the electrolytic capacitors or the high voltage of the, in the old days you had a metal cased cathode ray tube, a metal shield, metal, the neck and flare portion of the cathode ray tube in many cases used to be metallic, and so certain sets could hold a pretty high voltage for a pretty long period of time. So I think you're saying that TV set that you came in contact with was not plugged in at the time. Is that what you're saying, Dennis? Go ahead.
That's correct. It was sitting on the sidewalk, and yeah, it was probably the capacitor in it, and I got in there with my screwdriver and figured I was going to figure out what was going on with this thing, and it was holding a lot of power, and it sent me a good distance. Over.
as I remember seeing, was that at Airborne Instruments Laboratory, in one of the laboratories, there was a three-phase, I'm not sure if it was 220 or 440, and the power was supposedly off, but it wasn't. And a person was doing rewiring of the primary of that transformer and put a screwdriver across two of the terminals. And the arcing of that screwdriver burned his eyebrows, the hair on the front of his head, sunburned his face. I'm amazed it didn't do eye damage. The 30-ampere circuit breaker did not trip. And that's a bit amazing to me. So this was a very heavy ampere-capable power supply, which I think was 440, three-phase. And as I said, just a simple screwdriver across the two phases did it. Can do an awful lot of damage. Got to be careful. Nowadays, thank goodness, the majority of our transmitters are transistorized, running on numbers like 12 volts. And under most circumstances, 12 volts is pretty safe. But there are examples of how you can make better, good enough contact to a human being where I think 12 volts can get you in trouble. It takes an unusual situation, but it's possible. When it comes to external circuits at a home, let me drop. Most things that are outside wiring, I think the number is like 26 or 28 volts, they consider safe. For normal circumstances, that's probably true. But once again, if enough area of the body is coming in contact with that 28 volts, I think there's a slim chance that can become lethal. These experiments I'm doing with the salt water leads me to believe that a lot lower voltage can do it under certain circumstances. Don't go in water when there's electricity. That's for sure. We've only got a couple minutes left. What you guys have listened to tonight is John and Dick's random ramblings of TechNet number 4134. And next week I'll give you a little bit more information about chocolate bars. And it's a little bit different than I expected. But chocolate bars in a microwave oven. The Percy Spencer story, the man who invented the microwave oven. And when you look up Percy Spencer, he should have been a ham radio operator. He's a real self-educated guy. He didn't graduate from grade school. And yet he eventually got the title of doctor at the Raytheon Company. And he was doing major managing of a research department. So he was doing some extremely good work with the development of magnetron tubes and finding ways of making a tube that you could barely produce one of them in a week. And he managed to produce thousands of them in a day when he finally came up with the much better manufacturing techniques. And it was that magnetron that led him to believe that a microwave oven was possible. And after the chocolate bar incident, he then used the magnetron tube to pop some popcorn and to cook an egg. And because the egg was all in the shell at the time, and the egg exploded and put egg yolk all over his face. But he knew that cooking with a microwave oven was very possible. And I have no doubt that he was the inventor. But I've got a lot of problem with the chocolate bar story. You'll hear more of the details of that next week. Let me pass it over to John if he's got any further words. And just tell me of the subject matter. Had you decided to... Tom, we heard you. I'll go back to you in a minute. Had we had time to go to another one of the mailbags, what would the subject matter have been? KC2WGB, K2LIW?
An experiment somebody's doing with a fluorescent light as an antenna, Dick, which I mentioned last week, but we never got around to it. But we'll catch that next week.
Yeah, putting a fluorescent light near any kind of a radio transmitter can be a lot of fun, near the antenna, near the transmitter. I vaguely remember I was putting a fluorescent light in the vicinity, not even touching anything, of the plate of an 807 tube while it was transmitting. Just putting it in the near vicinity. I remember getting a whole lot of light out of it. Fluorescent tubes are fun. Let's see what Tom wants to say to us. WP2CLM, T2RIW, go ahead, Tom. Looks like Tom may not be getting through. Go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, I hope next week we're going to have a time to go to your observation about the magnetic field as the primary the carrier of the signal in between the electromagnetic wave theories. I don't know how to put it together. That's an interesting subject that I'm really waiting for. Anyhow, great TechNet. Thank you very much, Dick.
Yeah, as you know, I'm slowly concluding that the magnetics is the real magic. And I think the majority of a radio wave is magnetic. And I'm a little bit skeptical about whether or not there's an electrical component to it, even though all reasonable measurements will show you what looks like an electrical component. I know we're going to be cut off in the next 60 seconds, so I'm going to say 73, you all. Bye-bye for now. Try to be kind to each other. K2RIW, clear. TechNet number 4134. Bye-bye.
Great, Matt. Okay, talk to you soon. KC2WGB.
Yeah, John, you going to go upstairs then?
Yes, okay.
Katie
2
and you want great
TechNet
tonight.
Hey, that guy Dennis has got good taste. Bye-bye, Dennis.
The time is 12 a.m. 73 and good night from the WQVL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30 WQVL repeater system.
WB2CLN 73 is Dick and everyone else. WB2CLN.
VE3JW, VE3ZTZ call.
VE3ZTZ, VE3JIW, VE3ZTZ, VE3JIW. VE3ZTZ, VE3JIW on MIS. VE3JIW listing on 9126.
Victor Radio Newsline, report number 1850, with a release date of January 25th, 2013, to follow in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The following is a QST. Hams in Iceland and Greenland get new spectrum. Hams down under get use of a special prefix for Australia Day. The United States hits yet another all-time high in amateur service license holders. AMSAT North America's main website is hacked, and two operations from Laos get DXCC credit. Find out the details on Amateur Radio Newsline, report number 1850, coming...
visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Tonight at 8:30, this is the WQV.